Welcome back to the Ed Morrissey Show podcast. Joining us as always, the Prince of Twitter, the Regent of RedState.com, Andrew Malcolm. I just like doing that because it sounds like a boxing match.
I know. Let's get ready to mumble.
Nicely done. Very good. Let's get ready to mumble. All right. Got lots to mumble about today. We're going to get to the Trump stuff because that is interesting. And you've actually written two VIP columns this in the past couple days about that, or past few days. But before we get there, we got to talk about what happened at the Washington Post. The Washington Post 3 years ago hired Sally Busby away from the Associated Press to make her, they called it executive editor. Basically, that's the, you know, editor-in-chief position. I think she was replacing Marty Baron, if I remember correctly.
That's correct. Yeah.
Over at the Post.
But that's a very hard act to follow.
Well, it is. And Marty Baron was there for a long time. Sally Busby was there for 3 years. And during that three-year period, and I don't think this is all Sally Busby's fault, but during that three-year period, the Washington Post just started hemorrhaging revenue and subscribers. I think they lost $77 million last year. I think that's a number I keep seeing floating around. So, you know, the buck stops at the top, but I'm a little surprised that they held Sally Busby accountable for that, given how proud they were to declare that they'd had their first female, you know, editor-in-chief or executive editor, you know, in the history of the Washington Post, and now they're dumping her for a couple of guys.
Yeah. I think technically she quit, but they created the conditions whereby she wouldn't. What they did was they took the whole news operation, which she had been running as she ran Associated Press as executive whatever over there. They took the whole Washington Post news operation and split it in three, and they told her she could run one of the parts. And that was to her and probably everybody else a demotion. So she left. And they're probably not unhappy about that. I have to say, I don't have any great insight from secret sources within the Washington Post, but as a former subscriber until last week, I found their offerings to be awfully soft. I had a wide range of stuff that I got sent to me and that I went and looked for, but their big pieces were unfocused. And when I was in journalism, we called it the nut graph. You know, you have this lead about Jerry and Bobby Williams, who are running this farm. It's the sixth generation farmers in the middle of Nebraska, and now they're having a hard time. And then there's the nut graph, which is the third or fourth graph that says why you should care about these people you never heard of until a half a minute ago. And they didn't have that. So it was like, oh, okay, two guys I never heard of. I don't really care about it. And, you know, as far as I know, they were well reported and well written, but it just didn't seem relevant. And they had lost, well, I guess a lot of print subscribers, but they had lost more than a half a million online subscribers. And depending on how much you're paying, that's found money. You know, I mean, the Washington Post makes their investment in news with paying reporters all kinds of money, and they put it in the paper, and that's it. But if you can repackage it online and people will pay something to see it, like I said, that's found money. And they had lost over a half a million. Now, that's a half a million dollars, even if they're only paying a buck a piece, which they aren't. So Jeff Bezos, who certainly has $77 million to throw away, he got $200 million on his yacht, I think. It got to be too much. So I think he sent word down. You know, he came for a town hall during the winter. And he just he wasn't happy with the way things were going. And they have a new publisher as of last summer, and he's been radically changing stuff. He's from the Wall Street Journal. Everybody seems to be going milking the staff on the Wall Street Journal these days. And he started making major changes, and this newsroom redesign is part of it. But he was doing a lot of other stuff, including some substantial layoffs at the end of the year, which you wrote about. And right. Lots of changes, and the changes sort of point the finger at Sally Busby. Now, obviously, everything isn't her fault, but she's in charge and the buck stops there. Yeah,
she's the quarterback, you know, she's or the coach, but one of the two.
Yeah.
When the loss comes, the L is all yours, you know.
Yeah. And the Associated Press under her kind of went woke too. So, too bad for Sally, but I have to say, if this is another sign of the decay of woke, I'm delighted.
Yeah, I agree. I heard that, you know, they went through the layoffs. Busby was the one who did that. And from what I've seen and from what I've heard, and I don't want to be too specific about that, because I have heard a couple things, but from what I heard, the layoffs were basically done on the basis of, and this is typical for corporations, right? I'm not saying that this is a Busby innovation, but it was like, all right, who were Marty's guys?
Oh yeah.
And so it was a little bit of empire building. At least from what I've heard, ambiguously, and I can't go on the record here, so take it with a large grain of salt, if you will. But what I have heard is that the people who got the axe were Marty's guys, and it didn't really make any difference whether their work was attracting subscribers or not. She basically wanted to clear the decks and get her own people in place. And look, I mean, that happens every day in the C-suites of corporate America. This is
absolutely new. Absolutely. We used to say on the New York Times, all change is bad. There weren't that many changes there because in my days, the New York Times was riding high and mighty and being very successful.
And they were promoting from within. When they had a leadership change,
that's right.
They came from within because they were being very successful. You don't go outside unless you don't think that you can, unless things are going wrong and you don't think anybody on the inside can fix them.
That's exactly, that's very astute. Yeah, that's definitely what you do. There were a lot of legends on the New York Times, and I worked for them. And oh my God, Harrison Salisbury, James Reston, Clifton Daniel, Abe Rosenthal, Seymour Topping. I mean, there were big, accomplished names who were not, what do you call it? People who just filled up chairs. They were people who had done it. So they knew what they were looking for when they hired. And they picked me, Ed. But yeah. I was a lowly copy, or what are they? A news clerk. And then 6 months later, I was promoted. Are you ready? News assistant. No byline. You got a byline on the New York Times. I don't know what it is today, but in those days, you got a byline after you became a reporter and had a 15-week probation period. And I can remember I became a reporter after a year as the news assistant. That was the deal I had with the editor, that because there were people on the Times who hung around forever. They were there like 6 or 7 years writing stories on their own time, trying to get promoted. And I didn't want to do that. So Mr. Topping said, I'll tell you what, you work for me for a year. If you're good enough, I'll make sure you get on the staff. If you're not, you agree to leave. And that seemed fair to me. Yeah. So anyway, I got on the staff, and 15 weeks later, to the day, Ed, I did a story that went to the foreign desk where I had been working for two and a half years. And there was my first story. It was an interview. I think it was the prime minister of some Caribbean nation. And there at the top was by Andrew Malcolm. And of course, once they see that in type, then they put that in the standard. This is the one we call on. But they left the H out. So when no one was around, I went and I wrote the H in Andrew H. Malcolm. And I got my first byline. And that night, I lived just a little bit in Jersey. I took the bus into the city to the Port Authority terminal where I knew the first edition papers were. And I may have bought more than one copy of my first byline in the New York Times. It was a huge day. It was 10 years after I wrote about this in one of my memory pieces recently. It was 10 years after I said I wanted to work for the New York Times. I got a byline. And when I left, there were something over 5,000 of them in the file. So it was great fun. But the Washington Post was a real competitor in those days. They, of course, broke the Watergate story. New York Times broke the Pentagon Papers story. So there was a real rivalry, major rivalry going on. I forget his name now, but they had the editor. They had the editor there. Jason Robards played him in the movie.
Ben Bradley.
Yeah. You know, funny story about Ben Bradley. He was older, and Sally Quinn, who was their major feature writer, and they became an item. And so he asked her to marry him eventually. And it wasn't on Twitter, but somewhere she wrote, she said, "This is my first marriage and his last." Anyway, yes, those were halcyon days. And it's not confined to the Washington Post. The quality of people coming into journalism, in my opinion, has declined. And I think it shows in the product they produce. I guess that's what you do to products, is you produce them. But
absolutely. It is a product. I mean, you know, it just is. It's, you know, you're marketing it, you're selling it in a newspaper. So it's a product. But I, you know, we've talked about this before, and the reason why I think that the quality is greatly declined, I want to talk a little bit about who's replacing Busby too, because I think that's an interesting angle on this story too. But before we get there, it's because of the process that was in place when you were coming up, and they don't use that process any longer. They don't much rely on it, if they even still use it at all. They're just hiring kids out of J school and making them reporters.
Yep.
Putting them on beat and stick them in the White House. You know, Ben Rhodes joked about that.
It's cheaper, but you don't have any experience. Like I said, on the New York Times, there were people, I don't know about the Washington Post, I assume it was the same back in those days. This is pre-early 90s. You spent time, as I said, a news assistant or a news clerk or a leg man, a rewrite person, learning the business, but also the culture of the place, the intensity on being accurate and being first, but being accurate was more important. And the behavior, the demeanor professionally of what you did, and the concept that there would be a Jason Blair who would be promoted not because of any journalism experience, but because of other priorities they had. He checked boxes, and he totally made up the stories and the interviews of interviewing Jessica, whatever her name was, the woman that the special ops guys rescued in Iraq. He just made it up, and he didn't even leave Brooklyn. I mean, to number one, to hire somebody who is so stupid, he's going to make up stuff in the New York Times and not think he's going to get caught. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And the Washington Post had a problem, too. They got to pull a surprise for a woman who created a fictional boy in the slums who was trying to work his way out. And she told a sad story and the kid didn't exist.
Yeah.
And they did not return the Pulitzer.
No. Well, they never did return Durante's Pulitzer either for.
Yeah.
Saying that, Gareth Jones's reports on Ukraine were all wrong and that things were going swimmingly there in Ukraine.
Yeah.
Lots of Ukraine.
Stalin is basically a good guy. He gets the trains running on time and weeds out villains.
Yes.
You're absolutely right. It wasn't perfect in the old days, but it was sure much stricter than it is today.
It's a different culture, right? It's a culture
absolutely.
Earning something versus entitlement. And that goes beyond the whole DEI thing. I mean, you talk about that.
Exactly.
And you had to earn your way into a byline back in the day. And what they've done is they've substituted credentialism for it, right? Oh, you came from journalism school. You must be ready to be a reporter. And like I was just saying a moment ago, you know, Ben Rhodes made fun of this during the, I think it was the last year or two of the Obama administration, saying it was so easy to pull the wool over the eyes of the media because all the reporters are younger than 27 and none of them have any life experience.
That's right.
So they'll just write anything you tell them to write.
That's right. Especially if it looks like you're leaking it because nobody else has it, even though there's three other people leaking different aspects of the same story. It's just pathetic. People get promoted. It's the Kamala Harris, only in journalism. They get promoted because they check boxes and not because of any quality of work or intellect or values, none of that. But I'll tell you what, in the old days, you got your ass chewed if you screwed up and if you created, and it didn't take long to create a reputation for sloppiness. Oh, boy. You got burned big time.
Yep. All right. So I want to welcome everybody to the Get Off My Damn Lawn podcast featuring two old guys shaking their fists at the clouds. I'm just kidding. We're just joking. All right. I do want to talk a little bit though about who's replacing us.
Yeah. You're good today. No. You're on today. No, I know. You're right. You're not as old as Clint Eastwood, but you're right.
Yeah, exactly. Thankfully I'm not as old as Clint Eastwood, but so they're firing Busby, who was, you know, again, sort of the DEI maven over at Associated Press. Who are they replacing her with? Even though they're kind of insisting that it really wasn't a replacement, so, you know, per se. They hired people from the Wall Street Journal and the Telegraph, the British newspaper, the Telegraph. Now, the Wall Street Journal and the Telegraph are perceived, and I think accurately so, to be more right of center publications. I don't know about the specific two men that they're bringing in from the Wall Street Journal and the
Telegraph. But they were a team on the Wall Street Journal.
Oh, they were a team on the Wall Street. Okay.
Yeah. And of course, they're white. The Wall Street Journal, which is Murdoch and News Corp, they've been hiring editors and journalists for a long time from Britain. And I think there's another one there. New York Times hired, the head of the BBC to run the New York Times for a while. And I think he's the guy at the Post. I think he's the publisher at the Post. New kids from college, hiring them shows you really don't care about the product because they don't know squat. And
but what does then, it say that they're hiring two people who came from conservative public or perceived as conservative? Yeah,
I'm not sure it's a sign of political. Jeff Bezos is a big, big liberal. But they're hiring three guys, and I guess there's some rumbling in the Washington Post of three white guys.
That's the problem.
Yeah, exactly. Another thing that wouldn't happen would be, in my day, would be a newsroom revolt like they did on the New York Times when they published, the Tom Cotton op-ed saying, maybe we need federal troops in the cities, which happened back in the 60s in the riots. So this wouldn't be unprecedented. But anyway, there's turmoil, and I guess people who are angry forever at journalism and it's lost its credibility, there's a great deal of satisfaction in seeing that. I get that, but I also get the fact that a democracy needs a strong, the founding fathers knew this, needs a strong independent press. Unfortunately, we don't have a strong independent press that has the values that it needs to have to be the appropriate watchdog. So all kinds of stuff slips through, like Hunter's laptop and all that stuff.
Well, and that's part of this, because the editors that they're hiring are coming from the same reportorial class that they're hiring, mm-hmm. and they don't really have that professionalism that is from the craft rather than from credentialism.
Right. Millennials were not educated to learn history, which is crucial. I mean, everything comes around again. I'm sorry. It does. I saw a wonderful video. You and I exchanged videos from whatever it is, Instagram. And there was a video of a woman pretending to be a millennial and talking about the women who were on the Titanic, saying, "The ship, it sank. So annoying." and then looking around in the lifeboat, like, this is such a normal ocean. You can make fun of millennials, and they kind of earned their not all obviously, but they've earned their reputation, and it's because of the education. We dropped history, we dropped the classical studies. I'm not talking about Latin because I failed, but I'm talking about some core subjects that shape the way you think. Critical thinking. I think I mentioned this once a few weeks ago. When I was in journalism school, one of the teachers had us write a review of some cultural thing, a museum. I did one on a play, and we turned them in, and he graded them and commented and all that stuff. And we all came in the next week, and he said, "Okay, now you write a review the opposite of what you saw." And it made you think to be critical, and be critical of yourself, because 90% of the reviews were positive, because those are the easy, negative, because those are the easy ones to write. "Oh, this sucks. It's terrible. Blah, blah, blah." Then you had to go and write something that was positive. It was a good lesson, but it was one of many on how to think critically. Somebody tells you something, like, for instance, it's a small thing, but it's an important thing. Trump's amazing cash haul after the verdict. Okay. Now, they said, first of all, they got 34 million, 35 million in the first 24 hours, and it was 52 million, and now it's up past 70 million. That may be true, but if you're an honest journalist, you always hang it on who's saying it if you can't verify it. So you say the Trump campaign claims, or the Trump campaign says it collected, because these numbers won't be official until mid-July, when they have to submit them to the FEC, and the FEC accepts them, and if they're not accurate, those people get in trouble. But right now it's just people talking. I could tell you, Ed, that people love my last column so much they sent in $1 million, and
wouldn't that be nice?
And I wouldn't mind. I might not say it, but it's like you say, when I win the lottery, I won't say anything, but there will be signs. My phone number will become unlisted.
It'll be very difficult to find.
That's right. There will be signs. I have more dogs. Media, we talk about it often, but it's because it's so important. And right now, it's only important because they screw up so often. Yeah, they screw up.
We can talk about a little bit about your two columns here.
No, let's talk a lot about the two columns. Okay, let's talk
a lot. A lot about your two columns here. Conviction of Donald Trump last week on Thursday, and the way that the media has been covering this, I mean, the verdict itself they covered fairly straightforwardly, but after that. You know,
there was some joy. There was some joy in that cup, some glee.
And then Donald Trump gets out there, calls it a sham. And they go, well, you know, there's no evidence that this was a sham trial. It's like, when we get to the appeals court, then you can take a look and see whether or not the appeals court thinks it's a sham trial. And B, you've got lawyers across the political spectrum going, this thing is a bad case. And, Ellie Honig is on CNN and in New York Magazine telling readers there, this is terrible. Matt Taibbi, saying the same thing, that it was a sham. That's the word he uses as well. This was a political witch hunt. It was a get him at any cost type of manufactured charge. And the trial itself, from the reports, they didn't have it on television, but from the reports that I saw, looked, like it was handled pretty badly. And I don't necessarily expect the media to argue Trump's case for him, right? I mean, that's just asking way too much. But I would just say, why don't you just say, this is what Donald Trump said? Don't sit there and try to fact check it. That's what the appellate courts are there for. Just say Donald Trump called it a sham trial and another news today, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, they can't help themselves in editorializing in news coverage. And to me, this was a really interesting little exercise, right? Which news outlets were going to do that? Well, the Associated Press did it. I think the New York Times did it. The Washington Post did it. And not just the analysts where you can expect that, or opinion where you can expect that sort of thing, where it belongs, but in the actual news articles. Why? Because you got a bunch of 23-year-old J-school students who want to get their two cents in on this stuff.
Yeah, that's right. And they've learned that you can say wild things from the internet, which you didn't have in my day.
We talked about this one the last time, right? The one, it was the Hollywood Reporter thing on Richard Dreyfuss's remarks. I mean, this is totally a different topic.
Yeah.
But he's in the Cabot Theater in Massachusetts, and this is the Hollywood Reporter, right? This is one of the two major news publications of Hollywood, right? Variety being the other one. And I guess you could throw the Los Angeles Times in, but Los Angeles Times is a little bit more, general interest newspaper. The Hollywood Reporter and Variety focus on the entertainment industry. Richard Dreyfuss has been there for damn near 60 years, right? He was in The Graduate. That was 68. I think that was his first film role. And the Hollywood Reporter never even bothers to get a quote of what Richard Dreyfuss said. They don't even have a secondhand quote. At least the Boston Globe had a secondhand quote about what Richard Dreyfuss said. And it wasn't anything, earth-shattering anyway.
Yeah.
What did they do? They went online and just started picking out tweets. Oh, so-and-so tweeted this, and oh, so-and-so tweeted that. And I said it was like covering the World Series by watching a tape delay of spring training.
Yeah. Oh, I know. It's so lazy and incompetent. And the fact that you have editors who don't throw it away.
So you have a really interesting column on this, and you And you picked up on something that Ben Domenech wrote, which I think is, I've called it a hush money trial because that's sort of the basis of this. Everybody's been calling it a hush money trial, but Ben's right about this. That's not accurate. It wasn't really a hush money trial. There's nothing illegal about paying hush money trial. He says it's the business expense categorization trial claimed as a campaign finance matter trial, which makes it sound rinky-dink. And that's the reason why they don't use that. You know,
they
use fraud. Well, it wasn't really a fraud case either. Nobody was defrauded. It's like this. It's like, you know, the other trial, the civil trial with Trump, fraud trial where he's going to have to pay $450 million for defrauding nobody. Nobody lost money in those deals.
Who was the victim in this hush money?
Nobody was the victim. I'll tell you who the victim was. It was Trump. Trump was victimized by this trial. But I mean, in those ledger entries, nobody was victimized by that. It was
and Hillary's campaign in 2016 made the same fraudulent claim. It listed the money for the Steele dossier, the Russiagate hoax. It listed that as a campaign expense, which it wasn't. Okay. And what did she get? $130,000 fine from the FEC eventually. That's it. No charges, no trial, no big hoo-ha. It was Hillary. Hillary who got off for Benghazi, Hillary who got off for destroying emails and no security on her national security things using a private email. So she gets scot-free because it's the establishment in the swamp that takes care of those people. And same thing for Solyndra. And Benghazi, that it just burns my butt. You may have gathered that over these years. It just burns my butt that nobody got hauled up for Benghazi. The president himself disappeared at 5 p.m. on that Washington time on that day. We didn't see him for 16 hours when he came out to denounce the death of four Americans. Nobody ordered rescue. Nobody ordered cover. Nobody apologized, but just four dead loyal Americans. And nothing. They did a ARB accountability review board by Admiral Mullen, who's on all these Sunday talk shows, who's establishment former, I think he was chief of staff in the Pentagon of the armed forces. So he did an alleged thing. He went down, he saw the documents that Hillary's chief of staff selected for him to see. He interviewed some people. He never talked to the woman who was in charge that night. And he comes out and says, no, there's nobody at fault. It's just systemic failures. And the media buys it and we move along, and except for the four people who are dead. And the world is like, well, whatever. I just can't. I have trouble with that, Ed, as you may have gathered.
Yeah, you're not subtle about it, man.
Subtlety doesn't work on these topics.
Yeah. No, it doesn't. Your other column was equally good. Now, this was written before the verdict actually got handed down,
right?
But it's still very much worth reading. And
what's the headline, Ed?
The headline is Joe Biden eyes address on Donald Trump verdict, but does anyone truly care? Now, here's the interesting thing about this. Because this was part of, this actually started maybe a week and a half ago. It wasn't last week, but the week before last, when the White House announced that Joe Biden was going to have a address from the White House when the verdict came in the Donald Trump trial. And all of us are going, why would he do that, right? Why would he do that? Because he's been trying to keep hands off of this until very recently. And then the following Monday, I think that was on Friday, right? That was on a Friday. The following Monday, they said the campaign creates an event about less than a block away from the courthouse in Manhattan and sends Robert De Niro out there to address the media. And it turns into an absolute, apologies to Salem, it turned into a shit show. Robert De Niro started cursing at the people on the streets, because the people on the streets were heckling him as a loser and as a has been. And he starts yelling, you know, F you, F you, F you, back at these guys. It's all on video, right? Even the part before that, he was ranting like a lunatic. Donald Trump is going to destroy the world. Oh my God. We have to stop him any means possible. Maybe his worst performance since Bad Grandpa. So you were writing about this, and people really need to read this column. But what happened in the end is they thought better of it after the De Niro meltdown, and everybody said, "Why are you politicizing this? It's already politicized. Why are you tying yourself to the politicization?" And all of a sudden, it was like, humina, humina, humina. And they finally stuck him out there on the dais to talk about foreign policy. And he just kind of worked in a statement about
knowing full well he'd be asked, and he could not answer and smirk.
Well, I mean, at least they were thinking at that point in time.
Well, what they did first, this is a trick that politicians or their staffs do. What they did first was leak that he's going to speak after the trial. And what that is that's a trial balloon. And what they got was, unlike the Chinese spy balloon, they got shot down by people going, that's terrible. And so they didn't do it. They set up an event where he could do it with his back of his hand. But that this is how you get used. When you see something that isn't sourced, you say, Biden administration, who asked for anonymity because of the sensitivity of the subject, say that the president is planning to make a speech from the White House, because then it wouldn't be political. Please. Please. Yeah. And there's not that many of us that call him out on it. We do, and the people who follow us get it, but a lot of people walk into the living room, they hear the evening news, he didn't speak about it. That's good. What a classy guy.
I think that's getting less and less. I don't know if you're right.
I hope so. I
mean, you take a look at the reaction to the verdict, right? And I mean, this is in the clear. We don't put it behind the paywall at Hot Air, because we've been doing this for years and it's a lot of fun. And I want everybody to be able to enjoy these conversations. But and we both do enough behind the paywall to where I think we can offer this to everybody in the clear. But we had an enormous response to membership last week. And I mean, not just at Hot Air, across the board. And I think people have decided that they absolutely have to get engaged in this cycle. And, you know, Donald Trump, I've seen estimates of up to $250 million since the verdict was read. But I mean, through the Donald Trump website in the first 24 hours was something like $59 million.
Yeah.
You had people like there was a Silicon Valley liberal guy who had never voted anything but Democrat in his entire life, donated $300,000 to the Trump campaign. That's the Trump RNC partnership campaign that he contributed to, because you can't do more than, I think, 5,200 in a cycle for an individual donation to a candidate. But if you're donating to the RNC, you can give as much as you want. So he donated $300,000 and wrote a lengthy essay on Twitter talking about why that was important. Sean McGuire was his name. So I don't know. I mean, I think it's changing. I think really.
No, I think you're right. It is changing. I hope it's not. What would you call it? Premature elation. I hope. that people are celebrating, that they remember this come November, which is still a long time away in political terms. There are the debates, theoretically, at least on the schedule for the end of this month, and then another one in September, and there's two conventions. I hope the outrage survives. But you're right, it is building.
Well, we're coming up to the end of this. I do have to point out something, though, to our viewers. If you'll look behind me, you'll see a fairly new feature. Now, I had my scanner up there, my new book scanner by Caesar, CZUR, which is actually pretty awesome, and I'm going to write a review about it. Something. I mean, I bought it myself. Caesar has nothing to do with it, so I'm not plugging it either. But if you need a book scanner, it's actually really good. And Andrew said it was a little distracting. So I decided that I was going to put something over it for our podcast. And Andrew, can you tell what it is that I've got over that?
No, I can't quite make it out, Ed. You better tell us.
That's a Steelers jersey that's over this. Now, there's a story behind the Steelers jersey. I was talking with Adam Baldwin about this, and I'm going to do this with Adam Baldwin. By the way, we're going to have an Ask Me Anything session, a live 1 hour session with Adam Baldwin on Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern time. That's also going to be outside the paywall. It's going to be Amiable Skeptics, but it's going to be outside the paywall. So for 1 hour, you can log in and via the comm box that our home office is going to run, you can submit your questions. Adam will answer any question that you've got about his career, about politics, philosophy, whatever you want. You know his fitness regimen, because he's a pretty fit dude. Whatever it is that you want to talk about. But he and I were talking about the Harrison Butker thing, right? And he said, you know, you can tell how popular that story is. He says, Harrison Butker's position was on traditional family roles, because not only is the jersey the top selling jersey in at NFL.com for men, it's also the top selling one for women now, since he made the speech. And I said, yeah, but, and here's my story. Do you remember when Alejandro Villanueva for the Pittsburgh Steelers went out and stood for the national anthem when the rest of the team was in the, this is a few years back, right?
The rest he of the was team, in the military.
He was a Ranger. He's an Army Ranger, right? And the rest of the team had gone into the locker room because they decided that they didn't want to be out doing one thing or the other. They were just trying to sort of duck the whole thing. But Alejandro Villanueva stayed out there and stood for the national anthem. And the rest of his teammates were a little miffed because they felt that he'd showed them up. But his jersey became very popular on NFL.com. I don't know if it hit number one, but it became suddenly very popular. And I put it in an order for it. And, you know, I never got that thing.
No.
I never got it. They sent me a note, must have been 2 weeks later or so. Oh, that jersey is now unavailable. But, you know, and we've refunded your money. But, you know, there's plenty of, I was like, yeah. How difficult is it to put his number and his name on a blank jersey? That's what you do for a living, right? I mean, that's the whole work.
Yeah, exactly right. Exactly right. They didn't want to promote it.
They didn't want to promote it. So I told Adam at the time, I said, you know, you should, just because it's number one doesn't mean that they're actually going to start shipping those things out. And I'll bet you they do the same damn thing. They're going to say
because that is NFL. I was thinking it was the Chiefs, but that is NFL.
NFL, it's the NFL thing that does that. It's not the team.
The Chiefs were 100% behind him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So Adam said, well, you should get a Villanueva jersey now to show that up. So I looked on eBay, and they actually had a brand new one for very inexpensive. So the nice thing about this is, A, I finally got my Villanueva jersey. B, I paid a hell of a lot less for it. D, it's actually the correct size, because a few years ago, I would have ordered a larger size than the one I just ordered.
Oh, that's what a great story. Wrong team, but a great story.
And D, none of my money went to the NFL. So I bought it for somebody else. Best of all worlds, Andrew. Best of all worlds.
You are the mover and shaker. Congratulations.
And you don't have to look at my book scanner.
Boy, it does everything.
I'm telling you. All right. So do you have any jokes this week? Or
I do not. The ones I have are unsuitable.
Well, I've got one. other than the jersey.
No, thing, that's a pretty good one. You gotta have to work hard to top that.
All right. So here's the one joke I have. Jokesoftheday.net. It was the one clean one that I thought would work today, by the way. Occasionally I will send Andrew jokes from Instagram, but most of those are probably not appropriate for our show. So guy named Joe passes away, and he provided $30,000 for an elaborate funeral. And as the last guests are departing the funeral, his wife, Helen, turns to her oldest friend, and she says, "Well, I think Joe would have been pleased by that." And her friend says, "Yeah, no, I'm sure you're right." And she says, "But how much of this did this really cost?" And she said, "All of it, $30,000. She said, "No, it couldn't have been $30,000. I mean, it was nice, but this wasn't $30,000. And she says, "Look, the funeral was $6,500. I donated $500 to the church. The wake, food, and drinks were another $500. The rest went to a memorial stone." So she said, "Well, that would be $22,500 for a memorial stone." "How big is the memorial stone?" And Helen says, 2.5 carats.
Hey-o.
2.5 carats. There you go.
2.5 carats. Yeah, that's a pretty good, pretty good size.
Pretty good size memorial stone right there. Yeah.
I saw a thing on TikTok where the guy says, "When I die, at the end of the service, somebody please take some flowers off the coffin and throw it to my friends and see who's next."
See, there you know, you had a joke.
I had a joke.
That was a good one. I like that one. I bet you nobody would be jumping over each other to grab that, though.
So no, that's no. Oh, it's toxic.
All right, man. Well, Andrew Malcolm is, of course, the prince of Twitter at AH Malcolm is where you can find him on Twitter. The regent of redstate.com. Great stuff behind the paywall. Great stuff in front of the paywall from time to time. He's got his memories series.
Next week, I think I'll have one.
There you go. 18 and counting. 19th one is coming up. So be sure to keep an eye out for that. And don't forget, one more time, I'll just say it one more time. On Thursday, 1 p.m. Eastern time, the Ask Me Anything with Adam Baldwin and myself. You can ask both of us questions. Pretty much everybody's going to want to ask Adam questions, and that's fine. He's excited to do it and looking forward to that. So again, Andrew Malcolm at AH Malcolm on Twitter. We will talk again next week, sir.
Okay. Thanks, Ed. Thanks, everybody. See you then.